More than 13 years ago, in August 1949, the United Nations held its first scientific conference. From 50 countries, about 1,000 scientists and technical experts came to UN headquarters, then at Lake Success, to exchange ideas on the conservation and use of the world's resources in the face of growing demands from an increasing population. Since then, scientific meetings on many themes have become regular events in the UN calendar, and the latest of them will begin in Geneva next month. In a way, it will resemble the first, grown to maturity. It will be bigger and broader in theme. 2,000 will come to it, from 80 countries. For it, 1,800 learned papers have been submitted, each one like a key. A key that could unlock the fabulous wealth of the modern world for the many millions who, while aware of it, have still to see it.
United Nations Radio presents 1,800 Keys. An introduction to the UN Conference on the Application of Science and Technology for the Benefit of the Less Developed Areas. Opening at Geneva, February 4th, 1963.
312 years ago, the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes surveyed the human condition of his time and came to the conclusion that there is continual fear. The life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. In a speech last year, UN Secretary General Thant recalled this persistent verdict when he observed,
"Throughout human history, men and women have toiled painfully and all too often vainly to give themselves and their children even the simplest elements of decent human living. And in the past, the degree to which the basic sources of human want and misery could be alleviated did in fact remain strictly limited. The resources needed to counter suffering were desperately scarce, it must be admitted, and men had not the technological means to expend them or use them better. And in generation after generation, all but a fortunate few lived in permanent want, undernourished, short-lived, victims of disease, watching their children die, ignorant, bound indeed to a melancholy wheel of incurable privation."
But now, today, in our generation, how far have we moved toward the revocation of the verdict of Hobbes? Sometimes it's hard to believe that such a verdict could ever have been given, with man's capacity for achievement what it is today. Listen. This is the voice of the American spacecraft Mariner 2, carried to us over 36 million miles as its telemetric eyes scanned the misty planet Venus last December. And soon to come, a similar voice from the Soviets' Mars 1. In Earthbound laboratories, perhaps even more significant feats. The physicists probing the nature of matter with giant machines producing more than 50 billion electron volts of energy. The biologists probing the secrets of heredity and the very substance of life itself in the molecule known as DNA. The chemists, linking their work with the biologists more closely every day, synthesizing new materials of almost any desired type, creating drugs that are revolutionizing medicine. This is big, spectacular science, with costs and certainly future benefits to match, and vast economic implications, even now. Here, once again, is U Thant.
If it takes $40 billion to go to the moon, great nations will go to the moon, creating vast new electronics industries and millions of new jobs. products and opportunities as they go along. It is no longer resources that limit decisions. It is the decision that makes the resources. This is the fundamental revolutionary change, perhaps the most revolutionary mankind has ever known. For, make no mistake about it, the revolution brought by science and technology to the developed nations is a revolutionary extension in human freedom. Freedom is choice. Freedom is the ability to act. In the past, it has been wholly limited by the unavailability of so many of the means of action. I cannot feed my neighbor if there is no food, and I cannot transport what food there is. That was the case in the past. Now, those old and dreadful tyrannies of shortage are being overcome.
Which is why, as part of the United Nations Development Decade, the conference at Geneva is being held in February. It's not a conference at which big science will be discussed. It's not designed to launch the world's poorest country on a flight to the moon, or to set up atom smashers in the desert. It's a conference which will demonstrate how, if we may coin a rather silly term, how regular-sized science can extend to the whole world the freedom from want that is enjoyed at present only in those countries where the scientific revolution has had its effect. It's a conference at which, as we said, 1,800 learned papers will be the basis of the discussions, 1,800 keys. As this program will run for exactly 28 minutes and 30 seconds, it can't possibly examine every one, see where it fits and what it will reveal when it's turned. But we'll try a few. First, here is the man who has headed the team who have done the preparatory work for the conference. He is the Secretary General of the conference, Professor Carlos Chagas, Director of the Brazilian Institute of Biophysics. He outlines the scope and the agenda of the conference.
Development is a word which covers really a lot of activities, and there is no way of establishing an isolated development. That means development in just one aspect of society. That's why the number of items in our agenda are really quite wide. They're covering 12 specific topics, which could be divided in, let's say, the physical part, which means natural resources, food production, transportation, and communications. Then we have the economic part, which is centered around industrial development and economic planning. Then we have the problem, which is very, very important and should never be neglected, which is the man's situation in the whole development. And for this, we have a section on health and another on the social development of cities and of the rural areas. On the other hand, the three topics of the conference will cover this essential need of the less developed countries, which is the need of increasing their human resources, their human powers, either by developing a social status for their population, which is adequate to the human condition, and developing at the same time the cultural and the technical aspects of its education. This means that an overall picture of development will be present at our conference, and we hope that much can be gained by it.
Let's take food production and natural resources first. Somebody with a talent for rather unconventional statistics has calculated that if everybody on Earth sat down at the same table for a meal, the table would go round the world about 21 times and would have to be lengthened by about 35 kilometres a day to accommodate the newcomers to the feast. Apart from raising a formidable dishwashing problem, this odd piece of information does underline the urgency of food production, more and better food production, to meet the needs of our mounting populations. It also indicates why keys to agricultural questions will be the most numerous at the conference. More than 500 papers dealing with science and technology on the farm and fishing boat have been submitted. Here are just a few random details.
Field testing techniques with chemicals to find out quickly the amounts and kinds of fertilizers which should be used in areas where farmers are just starting to use them. The use of gamma radiation in insect pest control by breaking the breeding cycle through the sterilization of the males. The treatment of arid or barren soil to increase its productive or carrying capacity. The improvement of fishing techniques through the use of, for example, nylon nets.
On that last one, there appears to be some evidence that fish can't see nylon, so you can go out fishing in daylight and not wait for darkness to lower the nets. For the conference sessions devoted to natural resources, more than 320 papers have been submitted. They deal with mapping and surveying practices, development of river basins, water resources, energy, and minerals. Others will cover the vital question of resource planning, the estimation of present and future demand. Another factor is the steadily mounting consumption of many of the world's resources, like oil and natural gas, and what this means for the future. Here, an Indian scientist, Mr. M.K. Gopalinga, who was a member of the preparatory team for the conference, has some interesting facts.
Known reserves of minerals are being depleted rapidly. We have to produce more and more of them from less and less deposits. Science and technology has enabled utilization of low-grade ores for extraction of various materials. We are now producing magnesium from seawater, which hardly contains 0.13% of this element. That is, 1.3 tons of magnesium in 1,000 tons of water. Copper ores with 0.9% of the metal content are now being treated economically, whereas over 70 years ago, even ore with 5% was considered unprofitable. Similarly, lead ores with only 2% of the metal content are now exploited, whereas 50 years ago, ores with 5 to 7% were required. Progress in this technology of using low-grade ores will be discussed.
Now let's turn to Agenda Item D, Industrial Development. 195 papers have been submitted, and they can be roughly divided into two groups.
The first contains papers describing actual production processes and giving an account of the most recent scientific and technical advances in, say, food processing and preservation, textile manufacturing, iron and steel, engineering, fertilizers, chemicals, building materials, and building techniques. The second group is designed more as a basis for discussion on the theories of industrialization, the approach to it in differing economies, free enterprise and centrally planned economies, and along the middle road, where state planning and private ownership are combined. Other papers deal with the important question of priorities in industrialization. What should come first in any given situation? Many of these describe the actual experience of various countries in developing their industries.
All forms of development, and industrial development in particular, implies, of course, change, often radical change, in a society that may have remained virtually static for centuries. The subsistence farmer changes to the production of cash crops, and cash can change horizons. Traditional allegiances to land and village may wither. The city's magnetic field gains in intensity and range. Rural-urban migration, that now painfully familiar phenomenon, increases from a trickle to a stream as the new magnetism exerts its force and as the improvement of agricultural techniques binds fewer and fewer people to the fields. In the already industrialized countries, the physical and social problems connected with the growth of cities have not all by any means been solved. Megalopolis, the giant urban sprawl with populations of 18 to 20 million, is already a fact in some countries. The Tokyo-Yokohama area in Japan, for example, or Greater London, or the eastern seaboard of the United States, with New York at the center. The question is, need the developing countries, now mostly in the early stages of industrialization, face the same monumental difficulties in 10 or 20 years? In most of them, the drift to the cities has already begun, and at the Geneva Conference, close attention will be given to many aspects of this question. 60 papers have been submitted on the social problems of development and urbanization. Some will deal with rural development, with what can be done to make life in the country attractive and rewarding enough to slow down the drift to the city, or even create a counter-tide. Others will concentrate on the urban problems that already exist, and on how to avoid them where they don't, to any marked extent. As an example of the sort of experience with such questions that will be shared at the conference, we introduce a member of the delegation of Poland, Mr. Adolf Cibarowski, the chief architect of Warsaw. He draws a parallel between Poland's situation after World War II and the present situation of many developing countries.
We started 17 years ago, when the country, as a result of the war, was almost completely destroyed. So, in a way, our starting point was similar to that of many of the young countries of today. We had to build up industry. We had to house millions of people. Today, many Polish cities are more modern than the average in Europe. The young countries have at the moment the tremendous chance of having in some 20 years' time the most up-to-date urbanization. Properly thought out ideas of town planning and urbanization will ensure all the amenities and conveniences not only for the present, but for the future generation as well. From this point of view, the conference in Geneva is of particular social importance. It will serve as a platform for exchange of ideas and experiences, and it will help to avoid all the mistakes that were made in the planning and construction of many European cities.
Mr. Cibarowski noted some of the difficulties already being tackled in parts of the developing world. He mentioned the very rapid growth of the population of Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, and of a number of cities in India. And he expressed the opinion that similar difficulties are bound to arise in most of the new African countries. He then returned to Poland's experience.
Poland is not a large country, but in the past 17 years, we built towns for some 10 million people. That includes the reconstruction and the extension of existing towns, as well as the construction of new towns connected with the newly erected industrial centers. Of course, we did make mistakes, but we also have considerable achievements. We shall present our experiences at the conference in Geneva, and I hope that they will be of benefit to the young countries in their program of urban planning and construction.
As we mentioned a while ago, this program can't possibly cover all the many scientific and technical aspects of development that this conference will discuss. But there are two absolutely fundamental questions that must be mentioned: health and human resources. Nearly 150 papers have been submitted on aspects of public health and nutrition. Particular attention will be paid to the planning and establishment of public health services, to the control of disease in the light of recent scientific and technological progress, and to the training of doctors, nurses, and all the other necessary medical personnel. In passing, a word about the specialized sessions at the conference on health service planning.
The general principles and methods of this type of planning will be considered in relation to local needs and overall development plans. To prepare such plans, a lot of basic information must, of course, be gathered first, so that a strictly realistic program can be worked out. Unfortunately, in a lot of developing countries, this basic information is simply not available, or is inadequate or inaccurate. So one specialized session will be devoted to the question of vital and health statistics, the gathering of them and their interpretation.
Now, the matter of human resources and their development. The term isn't a very happy one. It seems to equate a human individual with a lump of coal or a fine unharnessed river, something ripe for exploitation. Actually, it's simply a recognition that unless an individual's talents are developed to their full capacity, he can never enjoy or contribute to the standard of life now made possible by science and technology. It's been estimated, for instance, that primary schooling increases a man's productive capacity by about 40%, secondary schooling by over 100%, and university training by 300%. So it's not surprising to find that about 100 papers have been submitted for the Geneva Conference on the training of scientific and technical personnel. Some of them will deal with the programming of science and technology within the whole educational structure of a developing country, starting at the primary level. In a way, this is just as important as advanced technical training, because many of these countries face a severe and basic handicap. By way of illustration, listen.
10. No, not yet. 9. 8. 7. 6. 5. 4. 3. 2. 1. Blast off!
Two young citizens, fairly typical of their contemporaries in a rich, industrialized country. Two young citizens playing with toys, mechanical toys, spaceships of plastic to be launched across the bedroom.
I'm A-OK. I'm A-OK, Roger. Over and out.
Wait a minute, how's the atmosphere?
Not too good. Are you running out of air?
Yeah.
Okay, put the pressure on the rocket ship for a minute.
Toys that buzz and click and whir and flash with tiny lights. Toys to build bridges with. Toys to spark the imagination. And to introduce even the youngest player to the technological age in which he's living. He grows up among machines and learns to think in terms of technology.
What hit you?
Nothing. I'm coming back to Earth. I'm landing.
Oh, 5,000.
5,000.
3,000.
Run away!
With such toys unknown to millions of the world's children, and with little grown-up technology visible in their daily lives, this valuable technical attitude of mind may never develop, or be difficult to develop when the need for it arises. But to get back to the Geneva Conference, and one example of the sort of information it will reveal in the field of technical and scientific education, and in particular, mathematics. Irving Berenson of United Nations Radio interviews one of the men who will be there, Dr. Amos de Shelit, scientific director of the Weizmann Institute in Israel.
May I ask what you have personally found that is novel and of special interest in the many learned papers that have already been received concerning your particular field of work in the conference, Dr. Deschalit?
Well, my field in the conference covers international scientific cooperation and questions of training and education. And I was particularly impressed by the new achievements in the education of very young children. And here I refer primarily to the teaching of quite abstract notions of mathematics at the age of 5 or 6, and the teaching of languages at a very early stage in the child's development. I think that this particular point is of special interest to developing nations because there is still the tendency there to for young children at the age of 14, 13, to start earning their money. And it's very important for these children to be able to be trained as early in their career as possible. And the possibilities of training effectively children at the age of 5 or maybe even 4 in abstract concepts of mathematics, in languages, and maybe other subjects is something which the developing nations, I'm sure, would be very much interested in.
Dr. de Shelit mentioned, as one of his special interests, scientific cooperation. This brings us to the last aspect of the Geneva Conference, which we'll have time to mention. The sessions on cooperation in scientific and technical matters and the problems of transferring and adapting techniques to conditions in the developing countries. More than 90 papers have been submitted on these subjects, and they deal with this sort of situation.
At present, the developing countries generally have to import capital goods like machinery for their development plans. This is where the problems of technological transfer and adaptation can arise. Take the case of a manufacturer in a developing country. He imports the machines he needs, but he may find that they've been designed not with his needs in view, but for use in industrialized countries, where conditions may be very different. Then again, intricate machines may be appropriate for the skilled labor available in industrialized countries, but such skills are short in the developing countries, both to operate the machines and to maintain them. Hence the importance of the conference discussions on adaptation and transfer. As for scientific cooperation, one of the most striking proposals made to the conference so far is in a paper on the establishment of a scientific diplomacy. Working alongside traditional diplomacy, says the author, this scientific kind could help to solve indirectly the political, economic, technological, and scientific problems which at present divide the world. It's an idea that could stimulate some very interesting other ideas when the delegates come to discuss it.
And it's an idea which brings us right back to the beginning and to the very reason for holding this conference, for turning its 1800 keys. It is, as we said, one of the major early steps in the United Nations development decade, the new concerted attack on the age-old enemies of poverty, ignorance, and disease, which the General Assembly launched at its 16th session in 1961. In his speech on this decade, which we quoted at the start of this program, Secretary General U Thant said that science and technology are constantly creating new resources, that these new resources are giving mankind a new freedom, and that freedom is choice. We close with the concluding portion of that same speech by the Secretary General.
How is the new freedom of our resources to be used? Can our imagination match our abundance only when the ugly, destructive risks of war are at work? Is the only challenge we recognize the challenge of fear in weapons, in outer space, in international rivalry? Are they the only challenges before us? Is there no way in which the great constructive and peaceful purposes of men can so grip our heart and conscience that the spending needed to end starvation, to prevent the death of little children, to shelter the homeless and clothe the naked, comes to have first priority in the purposes of the human race? I must end with a profession of faith. I believe that ordinary men and women, once convinced of the ability to feed and succor and cherish their fellow men, will not rest until the task is done. The record of the human race is not all of war and horror and conflict. It has been sustained through generations by love, by quiet compassion, and by sympathy and affection for fellow men. Only the love has been limited by poverty. Today, it can be as unlimited as its instincts dictate.
You have been listening to 1800 Keys, an introduction to the United Nations Conference on the Application of Science and Technology for the Benefit of the Less Developed Areas, opening at Geneva on February 4th, 1963. The program was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.